It's 16 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the results of a pre-bond survey taken from some 700 respondents were presented to the Park City Board of Education at its meeting yesterday. In the studio with a look at what they found out, I have school board member Andrew Kaplan. He's joined with business administrator Todd Halber. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning.
So, Andrew, is it fair to say that the community isn't ready to decide and that the community is not comfortable with the board's judgment on how to best spend our tax dollars?
Yeah, I mean, look, the survey came back and it was very helpful to the board and the administration. I think what it said was clearly that the community is overwhelmingly aware that we need new facilities. What the hesitation is on is what the facilities look like and how to implement it. And as you mentioned, I think there is still there's still some scars from the 2015 bond. And some hesitation from the community in terms of supporting the district in moving forward.
So what does the board need to do then between now and November, or do you follow the advice of the consultant and wait for a bond election until 2018?
Well, I think, I can say when you hire a bond expert and a bond consultant, especially one that has had, very good success in the state of Utah and in our own community, I think it would be a bit foolish to ignore their advice. That's what they're experts in, and their polling is accurate and has shown to be accurate in the past, especially with the bonds that have been in our community. So I think it's good information for the board and the administration to look at and take a hard look at. We have until August to make that decision. But I think what we want is, we want to build community buildings. We want to build community schools. And if the community is split and roughly, there's a slight majority supporting the bond in the survey. It was 56% we're supporting. That's pretty tight. And that's without any type of no campaign being run or any type of negative press that could appear. And so I think we need to look at it as a district and say, okay, what's our best chance for success? And do we need to go out to the community? And I think the answer is yes. And how do we engage the community to see what they want our schools to look like and what they want us to do? So everyone agrees that we need new facilities. I think what the disagreement is the community is unsure what they want the buildings to look like.
Right. Now, did the survey outline what was even, because I haven't seen any specifics, nor even an amount that a bond would be floated for?
Yeah, so the survey looked at two different numbers. They looked at a $68 million number, which would reflect just the high school. And then they also looked at $130 million, which would reflect the high school, the 5-6 elementary, as well as land purchase. And they did that. They asked those questions to separate respondents. They didn't ask them to the same respondents. And what they found was that the support is actually relatively similar depending on the number, surprisingly so. I would say I think it was 56% it was within a few percentage points, which is the margin of error in terms of support for one number versus the other. But what stayed consistent was there were probably the equal amount. There are four different levels of support. There's strongly support, somewhat don't support, and strongly go against. And the for and the against were roughly equal, meaning the amount of people who felt passionately for the bond in our community is roughly equal to the amount of people who felt passionately against it. And I think that's what we need to work on, is the group of people who acknowledge that we need new facilities, but yet they're still strongly against the bond. And it's an uphill climb. It's a challenge. And we've started that process, by engaging some community members in community, input sessions. I think we're going to be creative as a district about how we go out and tell our story. We want to hold listening sessions. So not town halls where we're telling the community what we want to do, but actually the opposite, where we go out to the community and smaller groups and in larger groups and say, okay, what is it that you want? What is it that you need? What, the 25% of folks who were surveyed who felt strongly against the bond, what does it take for that massive group of people in our community to change their mind and say, you know what? Yes, we feel like we're listened to and we feel like we can move forward and support these buildings.
Right. So do you agree with the comments that you heard that the board isn't listening to the public?
Yeah, I think we're doing our best to listen. We've had community processes with both the high school and the 5-6, which is an ongoing one. And I think we're taking everything on board. I think it's a lot of this is legacy from the atmosphere that was created around the last bond. And it takes time. And, you know, our bond consultant said, you know, they pointed to Jordan School District, which ran a failed bond, and it took them 3 years to recover from, you know, that failed bond, to get out to the community and convince them that they were listening and that they were taking the input and admitting they were wrong. And, you know, we're trying to do the same thing. We messed up last time. And I think everyone acknowledges that, from the superintendent to the board to parents to community members. Everyone knows. And the encouraging thing I'd say is that the group who was the no campaign, the CBET group last time, we've engaged with quite a few of those people. And they all are interested in helping the district. They all want what's best for kids. They all want what's best for the community. And it's just a matter of time, I think, to continue to work with folks who feel like they weren't represented last time around, to get their input and to make sure that, you know, we're doing the right thing for the entire community. It's not about what the school board or the administration thinks is best. It's about what the community knows is best for them. So.
All right, Todd, maybe you're the money guy here. So if, in fact, the board chooses to wait until November of 2018 to have a bond election, how is the district going to pay for the high school expansion, which is pretty much ready to start, yeah?
Sure. So the options are still available in 2018 that are available in 2017. We still have a healthy fund balance in the capital fund. If anything, it might grow a little bit more in the meantime, as well as ready to do a financing deal. So really, all the options are there. Of course, interest rates are rising a little bit as we watch things in the marketplace, but also our tax base is growing at the same time. So those two might mitigate each other as we get into 2018.
Yeah. And then money to at least start the high school expansion, but what about building a new 5-6 school? Does that just get pushed down the line? Or
I think it works out pretty well. We have the 5-6 teams working right now, and as they do their loop outs with the community and get that feedback from the community and bring that into the discussions that they're having, the timing works out much better with the 2018, in my opinion, type of financing scheme. Because we'll have all those conversations concluded, and we'll have a good idea of what the community is behind and supporting.
Andrew, I wanted to ask you about what you think the perception of the bond is among parents of current students compared to those who have no kids in the school. Was that differentiated between in the survey results?
We didn't see that specifically. I think we know that certain neighborhoods are more in favor of the bond than others, and you know. Neighborhoods like Trailside, which is, you know, my neighborhood, tends to be more in favor of the bond than others. Partially that's because the kids have been in trailers for quite some time. And, you know, this fall we'll have even more schools in trailers. So I think, you know, I think the families who have kids in the schools have a bit more sense of urgency because they see the overcrowding and they see what we're looking at. But you know, again, there's a lot of families who have kids in school who have questions about the 5-6, and you know, that directly affects, you know, those families. And so, you know, we need to listen to those questions, and we need to listen to those concerns, and you know, and make sure that we can get the majority of folks happy.
Let's talk a little bit about the 5-6 school. Mm-hmm. You did get a design update. The school district owns three sites: Bear Hollow, Yacker Hill, Fields area, and then a parcel in Silver Creek. Pros and cons for each, traffic, a consideration for all of them. It sounded like Silver Creek is the least cost-effective site because we've got a dirt road and no utilities there. So when a 5-6 elementary school is built, what's the most desirable location in your mind? Have you made a decision yet?
I haven't made a decision. I think there's pros and cons to all of them. The site that's kind of obvious, assuming that the district doesn't acquire any more land, and that's kind of the other option, of course, is that we acquired more land, and there's a site that's appropriate for that school that's outside of the three that we've discussed. But of the three, it would appear that Ecker is the most logical from a cost perspective. The issue there, of course, is transportation, especially because of the planned parking lot that's going in across from Ecker in between the pull-off on 80. So there's a lot of considerations, you know, as we've learned with looking at start times and other issues in our community. We're getting a little landlocked, and, you know, everything that we build going forward is pretty complex, and traffic is always a big consideration, et cetera. So I think of the three in the presentation, you know, it looks like Ecker would be the preference at this point. But again, we would have to really take a hard look at the traffic implications on Kilby.
Yeah. So at what point, though, do you decide, you know, you've got to give some direction to start designing?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think that's the direction, you know, from my impression of the presentation, that's the direction that the committee is leaning right now. And I believe that, you know, we saw some schematics of the layout of what the buildings would look like at Ecker. And I think that, you know, we know that if, for example, if we did it at Bear Hollow, it would have to be a three-story school, whereas, you know, if we did this facility at Ecker, we could break it up and make it a little bit more space and have the students be part of smaller communities within a large community school, which I think is very important if we're going to have a cohort, you know, of 900 students who are in fifth and sixth grade, that we do something creative to make it so that they're part of smaller schools within that larger community.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, one of the bond amounts would include land cost. I mean, and we have heard before that, you know, the district doesn't need to say where that land is going to be that we're just buying some. Would that help, though, sell the bond if people maybe knew there was another option for a 5-6 school?
I think so, depending on where that, you know, depending on where that option is. You know, we know that there is, it's an interesting dynamic, Leslie, because there's a large percentage of our community, especially people who live within the city limits, who want, you know, the school to be in Park City limits. But on the same side, you know, on the other side, 75% of our students live in 84098. And so there's a large percentage of our community who wants, you know, a new school to be out in 84098. And so, you know, it kind of depends on where the land is available for us and what's, you know, what we can do. And obviously, if we have 75% of our kids coming into town, that has traffic considerations. But, you know, from what we understand, those traffic considerations are outweighed by the desire to have facilities here in the city limits. So we're looking at everything. You know, I think that's our job, is to continue to explore all options, to continue to look for any available land that's for sale or for trade. And we're going to continue to do that.
Okay. Just real quick, because I want to leave some time for Todd to talk about the budget hearing. But we've got something going up at Treasure Mountain. Can you quickly tell us what's going on there? Some construction there in the parking lot?
Yeah, so on the west side of Treasure Mountain are the two portables that we had talked about with the board over the summer, or I guess the spring months. So those are going up to be ready to be online for fall.
Okay, and then Andrew, during public input, you heard from three people. Two were Chuck mm-hmm. Klingenstein and Jim Tedford. They attend most meetings. Mm-hmm. You hear from them regularly. Chuck read kind of, in a very nice tone, kind of read the Riot Act, saying that the board needs to get out of their silo, that the board doesn't listen to the public and lack leadership. Would you like a minute to respond to that?
Sure. Well, I actually like Chuck a lot, and we spent a lot of time talking and brainstorming on how we can be more successful as a board. And he's someone who has a lot of experience in this town serving on boards. I think his interest, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Chuck was part of the Seabed group, and his interest is seeing the bond passed. And I think that's Jim Tedford's interest as well, is, you know, the good news is in our community, we don't have people who are anti-tax or anti-spending. What we have is people who want a good process. And all Jim and Chuck want is for us to do a good job and to listen to the public and be successful in passing a bond. And so I think, you know, you heard a little bit of frustration on Chuck's voice about the lack of change between the last process and this process. And his feeling is that, you know, we're not doing enough to listen. And my response to that is we're doing everything we can to listen. And it's a process. I think it just takes time for us to get out to enough members of the community and listen to enough folks where the community can change their perception of the administration and of the district to a point where they can support us again. And we're going to work hard to do that. We lost trust, and Trust me, I'm spending a lot of time, as are the other board members, to regain that trust. And we know we have a lot of work to do, but we're listening loud and clear to Chuck and to Jim and everyone else who wants us to be successful but is giving us constructive criticism.
Okay, no one commented at the budget hearing. The board did approve next year's budget unanimously. We get a break this year, Todd, but taxes will be going up next year to pay for the salary increases and all of the new positions. So maybe you can just summarize what that tax break looks like for this year only.
Sure. So the certified rates came in late Monday night, and so it looks like the decrease in a primary home of $650,000 value would be about $97. So you'd see a drop in the taxes then. Looking into the future for what the future needs will be for the district, the increase could be about $86, almost $87 in year two of the budget. And so that nets out, you know, to the advantage of the taxpayer in 2 years. And then the third year out, it looks like it would be about the same, $86, $87.
That's before the bond kicks in, then.
That's before the bond kicks in. So this is for the operations and staffing that we need to run the school.
Okay.
And what I'd like to add, Leslie, is that this is an example, you know, when the public questions our stewardship of tax dollars, I would like to point out that, you know, the Todd has done an excellent job and the administration has done an excellent job of balancing the budget and creating surpluses. And, you know, we increased our operating budget by about $6 million this year. And we did that without raising taxes. And in fact, next year, you know, as Todd just mentioned, you know, if we do have to increase taxes, it would just put them back to where they were already this year, you know, or actually even possibly less. So this year is a tax cut based on the district, and next year we'll probably bring it back to where it is right now. But that's, you know, that's prudent, you know, financial discipline. And I just want to say that we're proud of that. We've spent a lot of time and energy on that. And thank you to Todd for ensuring that. And that's something great for all of our community members and taxpayers.
Okay, the administrative compensation agreement and licensed professional agreements passed unanimously. What kind of salary adjustment did they receive?
So on the administrative salary, the increase works out to be about 5.2%. So there was a COLA built in and a step on their schedules. So that's comparable to what we saw with the classified, which had a 4% COLA and a step, and also with the teachers that had a 4% COLA and a step built in.
So we're talking of at least $7 million, though, in new salary costs for next year to pay for?
So that's a total of both new positions and salary. So it's about half and half between those two numbers.
And we're going to be able to do all of that again for even less than we're paying now.
Yes, we're the beneficiary of a legislature that has provided us significant money through the WPU as well as economic growth in our community.
Okay, anything else you guys want to mention?
No.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Todd Halber and Andrew Clappin, thanks for your time. Coming up on Friday, Park City and Summit County will be rolling out the first all-electric express fleet in Utah as the Kimball Junction to Old Town Park City Electric Express starts up. In the studio with details, I have Blank Fosbeck from Park City and Caroline Rodriguez from Summit County. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so we've got a ribbon-cutting ceremony happening Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Friday at 11 o'clock down at the Kimball Junction Transit Center. We'll be I say unveiling or starting up with our electric buses, but however, people have probably seen them running around town as we've been training drivers and working and getting the charging station in place.
All right. So when and where then?
Kimball Junction Transit Center, 11 a.m. this Friday. And prior to that, from 10 to 11, people will also be able to try out the electric bikes that we'll be launching next month. But the big event is really the launch of the Electric Express.
Okay. So do they drive differently? Is that why there's different training needed?
They're a longer bus. They're a 40-foot bus. Ours are have generally been 35-foot buses. But the electric has a little different nuance to it. As you let off the gas, you don't necessarily need to brake very much because they regenerate electricity. So training the drivers not to hit the brakes, but kind of anticipate ahead of time and let it flow into the stop, that generates electricity. And actually, they're able to generate back around 30% recovery rate as they're doing that. So that's one of them. And then just hooking up with the charge station, that's another nuance that they have as well, where they bring it into a point, some lines that are on the ground. They line up, and then they charge head actually talks to the bus and takes over the speed and brings it into the docking station. So they just have to kind of learn how to do that and how to recognize different problems on the buses.
Yeah. How often do they have to be charged?
So generally, they have about a 40 to 45-mile range. This is a 6.1-mile, well, it's 12-mile round trip. So they will be charged. We'll basically charge them every time we go through the whole loop. In the winter time, we'll be adding a charging station to the Old Town Transit Center as well by winter, so that when they're running the heater and that, they have kind of a redundancy and a backup. But basically, they can charge while the people are loading, and they can put anywhere from a 1 to 2 minute charge just to top it off to a 5 minute charge to bring it up to what they need. So it's pretty much just easier to just charge each time they go through. But they do have the capability, if there was some reason that they needed to get back on time on the route, that they could skip a charge.
So they have eight. We have eight of these, is that right?
We have six.
Six, okay. And then, and that's enough to do every 10 minutes, huh?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a 40-minute round trip. And so with four of them, we will actually be able to do it every 10 minutes. And then as we get into a busier season, the winter season, we'll be able to kick in an extra bus on that to keep that 10-minute range. And then we have one as a spare in case there's a breakdown.
Mm-hmm. And you say, so it takes 20 minutes to get from Kimball to Old Town or vice versa?
Approximately, yeah. Yeah, that's what the plan is. It's just slightly under that because of the time that they load at each of the stations. So,
what's it currently?
It's close. It takes usually people from Kimball Junction to here is around 40 minutes because of all the stops. If you ride the pink, it can take around 40 minutes because it goes in through Silver Springs. So this one will just stop at Canyons and at Fresh Market on its way into town, and then Old Town Transit Center. So basically there's the two ends and just two stops in between, which will speed up a lot, as well as we are working with UDOT, and we have an agreement to be able to use the shoulders on both sides, at least from Kimball Junction up to the Canyons, which will help. And then we're working on signal priority as well, hopefully to have that by winter as well.
So the stops at Canyons and Fresh Market will be both inbound and outbound?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. This is, we had mentioned, Utah's first all-electric bus fleet. I mean, are others in the state using electric buses?
There was one other they were doing at the University of Utah. UTA was doing a pilot program with an electric bus there, different type, using a different type of charging system. But that's the only one that we're aware of.
Yeah. So what are the cost savings here? I mean, are there any, given that these are more expensive than diesel buses and we're going to have to also replace batteries?
So actually, that's a good question. The buses have actually 30% fewer parts, so there's less maintenance. There's also these buses will be getting a regular bus gets around, diesel bus gets around 4 to 5 miles per gallon. And these will get 21 miles per gallon diesel equivalent when you do all the math with it. And so they'll be more efficient that way. We figure that actually we're doing a thing called where we're leasing the batteries. And so we're leasing them over the life of the, and what we're doing that with is the amount of that you would pay for the extra maintenance on a diesel, as well as the diesel fuel. We are taking that amount and operationally using those operational costs for that and paying for these leased batteries. What we're seeing is we will see about a $30,000 per year decrease in cost to run these buses. And that's through, you know, the estimates that we've gone through with that. But that will then help take care of that extra cost that it did cost for the batteries and for the electric buses.
So this express route starts on Friday?
Correct.
As of noon?
As of 1 o'clock it will start. We're going to have a little time there after the ribbon cutting to allow people to look through all six buses and to really check them out, maybe a few rides around the block, and then at 1 o'clock, regular service will start.
And how are we going to judge the success of it? I mean, my guess is that we may see a lot of empty buses running back and forth.
Right at first, as people are starting to get used to it and get used to what's there, you might see some of that. But the success will be basically as people realize that they can get on it and tied in with parking, not have to worry about parking up here. They can use their Wi-Fi. They can use all that on the bus and get here at the same time as parking. That's when the success will happen. So I see this summer, I'd love it to be like the full buses all the time, but it is a learning curve, and it's not only for us, but also for residents to get used to how quickly they can get in and out of town.
Yeah. And Caroline, you mentioned we're not rolling out the e-bikes until next month. I thought we were going to do that Monday.
July 14th is the launch for the e-bike program. But as I said, Friday we'll be demoing them before the launch of the Electric Express. And then next week you may see some electric bikes around town at certain locations, base of Park City Mountain, New Park, and people can just hop on them and give them a try and see how they feel.
So why did we have to push the start date back?
Just because of every part is ordered specifically for our stations, and they're manufactured that way. So there's always a lag in supply, of course. So we just had to wait for that a bit. But on Monday, the Camas commuter route is launching, and that will hook right into the Electric Express. So that's just another service that we're adding to our mix.
Again, that people are going to pick that up where in Camas?
At what we're calling the Camas Area Park and Ride, which is the parking lot next to the current Volker's Bakery, right across from Food Town.
All right. And again, that's an express.
That is an express service. There's only one stop between Camas and the hospital, and that is North Deer Mountain Boulevard, right behind the Deer Mountain Affordable Community, which was formerly known as Todd Hollow Apartments.
All right, and that again drops you off at?
It goes to the hospital, and you can then come into town, or there'll be a vehicle waiting to connect you to Kimball Junction Transit Center.
A vehicle waiting?
Yeah, another bus will be waiting, The good part is that we've timed it so it is waiting, so there's no lag time. You just get right off the commuter, right onto the connecting vehicle, and then you'll be right into the junction in 5 minutes.
Okay. Everyone's invited to come out then Friday?
Yes, please.
Yeah,
okay.
We'd love that.
All right. Starting at 10 o'clock for the bus tours.
10 o'clock for the bikes, 11 for the bus.
Okay. All right, Caroline and Mike, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Well, joining me now in the studio with a number of announcements from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, I have spokesman Tom Kelly. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie. What a beautiful day.
Yeah, so we're rebranded. It's no longer U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. It's just U.S. Ski and Snowboard?
That's right. A really big and busy week for us at now U.S. Ski and Snowboard. The organization formerly known as USSA or U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association is officially rebranded now as U.S. Ski and Snowboard as we move forward. Another milestone change in the more than well over 100-year history of our organization.
Yeah, the logo says U.S. We forgot an S or... You wanted it that way.
No, we wanted it that way, and U.S. for United States. And if you go to our website and check it out, you can see exactly what's entailed in the new logo that we unveiled. You know, it's been an interesting process. We had looked, even going back 4 years ago, as to how to bring more value to our organization. We had grown to become a very diverse organization with 7 different sports, 14 different national teams, and really, for sure, the most extensive and diverse national governing body in Olympic sport in America. So we spent the last 2 years together with an outside group of experts, some really key people like Gene Jackson, the top marketing person at Nike and a member of our board, to really look at how we could bring all of the disparate parts of our organization together into one to create more value. And this is where we've landed with U.S. Ski and Snowboard.
Okay, so we can hyphenate or shorten it as USS? Or is
no,
that
in
it's
fact,
just going to be.
We had a conscious discussion on this, and we chose not to do that. And I think what it'll do, we've been grappling with this because we've actually been using it for the past 6 weeks. Some people have noticed that, some have not. So we've been grappling with that, and it causes you to change your verbiage a little bit, but we intentionally did not want to create an acronym.
Okay, so it's U.S. Ski and Snowboard.
It's U.S. Ski and Snowboard, and we're really, really proud of that. The mark that you'll see, we actually did a soft launch of it in February. Folks may have seen it on uniforms at World Championships, and we let our athletes kind of play with it a little bit on their social media channels. And that gave us a chance to get some feedback. We took it to our entire stakeholder base at our USSA Congress, or formerly known as USSA Congress, 6 weeks ago. And this week for our partner summit, we've rolled it out.
Okay. And as you mentioned, it was on the uniforms, but the uniforms still remain very differently. It's just the logo on the uniforms, right?
Yeah, just the logo that's different. And it really stood out at World Championships this year. And the other thing, and really one of the biggest impetuses behind it, is to come together as one team. The Center of Excellence, when we opened that in 2009, it brought all of these athletes from different sports together to train with each other. And it's really helped us to have greater athletic success. This brand, the One Team brand, really brings us together. And you'll see a lot of our athletes tweeting and using Instagram with the hashtag One Team, which represents, you know, what we are. We're all together as one.
Okay. Also, some major announcement that Toyota has been named as the U.S. Ski and Snowboard overall sponsor.
Yeah, we had such a fun time at the Center of Excellence on Tuesday this week. We had three NASCAR drivers from the Toyota team in, and yes, Toyota has been named the official vehicle of U.S. Ski and Snowboard, and that goes across all sports. Some folks may recall that last year Toyota came on as the partner for the Toyota U.S. Grand Prix. We had an event over in Solitude in that series. Now we've expanded to cover all sports, and very excited to bring on this amazing company. Company that's also involved at the Olympic level as an International Olympic Committee sponsor and a U.S. Olympic Committee sponsor. So it's good to be in the family with that. We're proud to be one of the top sports, Olympic sports in America that Toyota is supporting. On Tuesday, we had three of the top NASCAR drivers, including Martin Truex from the Furniture Row Racing Team out of Denver, in the Center of Excellence, training with some of our top athletes, with Ted Ligety, Ashley Caldwell, Brian and Taylor Fletcher, a bunch of others were there working out with them. And they did a great two-hour workout using the ski simulators, doing some trampoline work, just some different conditioning and stretching exercises. And the real fun part came with a VO2 max test. And folks who don't know what that is, it's basically going all out for 8 to 10 minutes and then totally collapsing. We didn't put the drivers through that, but we had them watch Brian Fletcher do a session on the treadmill and watching him get his heart rate up to, I think, 202, if you can imagine that. And then at the end of this test, you just crash. And the fun part was 60 seconds later, Brian's up talking to these guys. So they were just blown away by the athletic ability that they saw, and also the great facility here in Park City.
So the sponsorship means money and vehicles then for you?
Yeah, it's money and vehicles. And you know, the way we look at our partnerships too is activation is an extremely important part. So we look for Toyota to be very active in engaging our brand with some of its other activities. And that was emblematic yesterday when we did have them in the Center of Excellence. We had an NBC crew. And it's an interesting crossover because NBC covers NASCAR for the second half of the season, beginning with Daytona in another 10 days. But they also cover our sports in the Olympics. So it's a great crossover. We had some NBC talent there and a crew, and we're going to be getting a little program into the NASCAR racing coverage of NBC and also with the NBC Olympic coverage coming up next season.
Okay, and then you also have an announcement with regard to the Grand Prix. What's happening there?
Today's announcement was the final schedule for our Toyota U.S. Grand Prix, which is the Olympic qualifying for free ski and snowboard. This year, we'll be doing Grand Prix stops at Copper in December, and then we're going to make our first foray over to Snowmass at Aspen in January, a new site for us. We're excited to go there. We have a long partnership with Aspen, but this is on a different mountain, so we're really happy to be there. And then we're going to wrap it up and name the teams out at Mammoth, a site where the very first Olympic snowboarding team was named back in 1990. So three great sites, and we're also adding to the Olympic qualifying schedule the Dew Tour at Breckenridge coming up in December. So it's a great lineup, very similar to what we had 4 years ago. We don't have Park City on that schedule, but we are coming back to Park City next year or the year after 2019, next season, for the World Championships, and excited to bring the sports back to our community as well.
Okay, and you've got the Partner Summit happening this week.
Yeah, tomorrow, actually tonight, we start our Partner Summit. We have over 200 partners coming into town. We also have a new Chief Commercial Officer, Dan Barnett. He was hired about 6 weeks ago, and he's making a very brief visit. We got him from America's Cup, and if folks follow sailing, you know that America's Cup is on right now in Bermuda, so he's taking literally about a 36-hour break to come here for the Partner Summit and then back for the Cup, and then he and his family moving here to Park City the 1st of July.
Okay. Hey, Tom, thanks for the update.
Great. Thanks very much.
3726.
Well, the Park City Community Foundation looking for ways to improve access to sports and recreation opportunities for our low-income Latino kids. In the studio with details on how you can help, I have the director of the Community Foundation, Katie Ryan, along with special projects manager, Diego Zagara. Good morning.
Good morning.
So apparently as the Community Foundation was looking at identifying gaps and issues within our community, what did you find, Katie?
Well, this hasn't been a gap that we've been aware of for a number of years, that there's barriers to participate in activities for low-income and Latino youth. But really, it was a donor who brought this challenge to us and said, I'd love to see more integration among our youth. And I think sports and recreation is our common culture here in Park City, and that would be the best place to start to make sure that we're kids are playing next to each other.
All right. So is it that kids aren't participating because they don't know about it, because they can't afford it, or because they maybe can't get there?
Well, there are a few barriers that we've identified, and our initiative, the Solomon Fund, is trying to address those barriers. They include but are not limited to transportation. It's hard for any working parent to get their kids to the soccer pitch or the mountain. Communication and outreach. Agencies seldom have the bandwidth to translate all their documents into Spanish and also put them out there to the Latino community. And the third big one we've identified is scholarships and gear. If a family cannot afford skis, jackets, helmets, goggles, it is unlikely that kid will be skiing this winter.
So is that where you noticed that we don't have Latino participation? Is what, with the snow sports? Or can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, we see them in soccer. We see them in basketball. And
there are a lot of agencies and organizations out there offering programs and leagues. The mountain is a place where they are underrepresented for sure. And everywhere else, after asking around and connecting with these agencies, we found that Latino kids are participating anywhere between 0% and 18%. The percentage of kids, Latino students at the school district is 21%. So that's one of our goals. We would like to see them participate at a rate that mirrors the Park City School District rate of Latino students.
Yeah, so do you have some cultural challenges there then? I mean, because again, basketball and soccer, are sports that are very well known. Snowboarding, not so much.
I think there is a little bit of that. However, there is an appetite for the families to participate. They would like to be out there. They're often wanting to send their kids to try new things. Sometimes there is a fear if you haven't done that sport growing up, you have not tried it once or twice before. I remember this mom telling me about ice skating and how she thought her little daughter would fall and break an arm. It never happened, of course. She was totally fine. But that can be an issue sometimes.
All right. So that would be success then, to see 20% participation in all the sports.
That's what we would like, 21% mirroring the Park City School District numbers.
All right. So how much do you have to spend on the effort?
We have significant funding. We have a really generous donor, and we're really looking long term. So in the short term, Diego and the team have been really great about connecting kids with programs and working directly with agencies. But in the long term, we want this to be the way sports is done in Park City. That is no longer acceptable to have programs that aren't accessed by all the kids living in the community. And we think the community really joins us in that effort. I mean, we've heard really positive responses. So we are thinking very long term in this program.
So how are you going to get that? I mean, outreach, you said, is an issue. I mean, so how are you just going to get kids in groups and say, look, these are all of the sports. What are you interested in?
So one of the initial things that we've done to address the barriers is communication and outreach. We're stepping in and connecting the Latino families that would like to participate in the opportunities with the agencies offering them. That is one immediate thing that we can do. The other one is providing grant money for scholarships so kids can participate in these programs. But I think that we don't have all of the ideas just yet, and which is why we're launching this call for ideas this summer.
Okay. And tell me how that works real quick.
So real quick, we are asking individuals, nonprofits, businesses, entities in town that would like to help us address the question of, can we get more Latino children to participate in sports and rec? And we're asking for them to send us their ideas. We're willing to fund them if the project is particularly promising, anywhere from $5,000 to $50,000.
Wow, that's significant. All right, so how do they do that?
We just opened the process, and we're asking for a one-page summary to start the conversation or a five-minute video. We'd like for that to include the basic idea, key partnerships, if applicable, a budget or cost, and we're asking for them to send them our way before July 28th.
Okay, and there's a lot more information on the website, pccf.org.
ParkCityCF.org, and you can also email Diego at ParkCityCF.org.
Okay, Katie, Diego, thanks.
Thank you. Leslie.